This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sidney Poitier has said that he always believed that his work should convey his personal values. When he started making movies in 1949, it was hard for African Americans to get significant film roles. It was even difficult to get small parts that weren't stereotyped. But in the 50s and 60s, Poitier starred in a string of films that addressed the racial tensions of the time. Films like The Defiant Ones, Lilies of the Field, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and To Sir With Love. In 1963, he became the first African-American to win an Academy Award for Best Actor, and he remains the only African-American who has won in that category. In the 70s, Poitier directed such films as Buck and the Preacher, Uptown Saturday Night, Let's Do It Again, and Stir Crazy. He's made new films since the end of the 70s. His memoir, The Measure of a Man, has just come out in paperback. Poitier grew up in the Bahamas on Cat Island and Nassau. His family was poor and he had very little education. He left for the U.S. when he was 15 and ended up in New York, where he was arrested for vagrancy and worked as a dishwasher. He saw an ad for auditions for the American Negro Theater and decided to try out. The audition was a disaster, and the director threw him out and told him to get back to being a dishwasher. Poitier was determined to prove him wrong. What did you do to try to improve your auditioning skills before going back to prove that this guy was wrong and that you could do it?
Well, my first job was to, because I had this Caribbean accent, as you, I'm sure you're acquainted with.
Let me just stop you there and say I can hear the accent much more in this interview than I hear it in movies.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had it very intensely and, so much so that he made a remark about it, and I knew that from what he had said that I had to do something about that first and foremost. So I saved up enough money to buy a radio, and I thought that the best way to correct it was to listen to a radio here in America and try to learn the sounds, the pronunciations and stuff from people I heard on the radio. And I did that, and I listened to the radio between dishwashing in terms of, in other words, when I'd get home, wherever I was sleeping, I would plug in this little radio and I would listen until I fell asleep. And whatever was said on the radio, I would repeat it. Like a parrot. And I would just listen and repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. And it took some months, and the heavy A in the Caribbean speech and the rhythmic sing-songy patterns began to fade, and I began to develop at least the rhythm and pronunciation of how people spoke in the U.S.
So you patterned yourself on radio announcers.
Yes. As a matter of fact, there was a gentleman in those days by the name of Norman Brokenshire, and I listened to him. He had a very arresting voice, and I liked the way he spoke, and I listened to him an awful lot. Didn't always understood what he was saying, but I listened a great deal, and I learned... I learned pronunciation of words that I was studying, I was trying to learn what the words meant.
So you went back to the American Negro Theater Company and auditioned a second time?
Yeah, I certainly did. That was my aim. I went back 6 months later and to audition. But I was really not really prepared because I didn't have a scene or a monologue from a play. I didn't know that one could buy such things in certain bookstores, so I bought what I thought would be appropriate for an audition. I bought a True Confessions magazine. And I memorized two or three paragraphs of this, of one of the stories in this thing. I didn't know any better. So I got up on the stage and I'm reading this thing, and I was hardly through the first paragraph when they stopped me. Oh my God, just thinking about it.
So it's amazing, really, that you were able to actually get a part after all of this. What? Just tell me, what was the thing that you did that you think convinced the right people at the theater company to give you a shot?
They didn't give me a shot. They rejected me after they saw my audition. And I made some observations myself while I was there at, mind you, this now, to put you in proper focus, the first place I went to when I was given the first audition and the guy threw me out, it was the American Negro Theater, and it was located on 135th Street near Lenox Avenue. They were in the process, I had no knowledge of this, of course, they were in the process of moving to a much larger space on 127th Street, and that's where I went for this for the second audition. And they had a larger stage, and they had a wonderful auditorium, and they had many seats. I think the first place on 135th Street had probably 40 seats, 45 seats, maybe 50. This new place had at least, they could hold at least 150, 200 people. Anyway, I noticed that they did not have a janitor there. So when they rejected me the first time, after licking my wounds for a while, I went back a few days later and I proposed to them, since they didn't have, and it appeared, as it appeared to me, a janitor, I would do the janitor work, which I perceived as being not a great deal of work, because I would just maybe mop the stage down from time to time and do the sweep up and get the garbage out, which I could do in a half hour or so, or maybe an hour. And I proposed that I would do the cleaning up stuff if they would let me come and study. And the people to whom I was speaking, they were the administrators of the American Negro Theater at that time. And they were somehow impressed with my determination. And they said, if you want to study that badly, you can come in. And so they took me in, and I was the janitor.
My guest is Sidney Poitier. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sidney Poitier. His memoir, The Measure of a Man, has just been published in paperback. Let me advance the story a little further and take you to the early part of your movie career, specifically to Blackboard Jungle, which was released in 1954. This was an important film for you. You had one of the leads in it. This is like the most famous high school film, I think. It opens with Rock Around the Clock. Glenn Ford plays the new teacher at a school just filled with juvenile delinquents. And in your first scene, he catches you and some of the other guys smoking in the bathroom. You're washing your hands with your back turned toward the teacher for most of this scene. Let's hear this scene.
What's your name, wise guy?
Me? Miller. Gregory Miller. You want me to spell it out for you so you won't forget it?
You don't have to do that. I'll remember, Miller.
Sure, Chief, you do that.
Or maybe you'd like to take a walk down to the principal's office right now with me. Is that what you want?
You holding all the cards, Chief. You want to take me to see Mr. Warnicky? You do just that.
Who's your home period teacher?
You are, Chief.
Well, why aren't you with the rest of the class?
I already told you. Came in to wash up, Chief.
All right, then wash up. Just cut out that chief routine, you understand?
Sure, Chief. That's what I've been doing all the time. Okay for us to drift now, Chief?
I want to catch you in here again.
Suppose I got business here, Chief.
Look, how many times do I have to tell you? Let's go, huh? Come on, let's go.
Sidney Poitier, how did you like your role in Blackboard Jungle?
I liked it. I liked it. This young guy that I played, he was really on the cusp of finding himself in useful ways or losing himself,
mm-hmm.
to forces he couldn't quite understand by then. And so he had some complications, he had some complexities, he had some depth to him, and I liked playing him.
Well, you became the African-American leading man in the 60s. What were some of the things that you felt you weren't allowed to play or express as an African-American leading man in the 60s in Hollywood?
That is a very good question. And the true answer is I have no such imagery of what I was not able to express, because taking the times as they were, the fact of my career was in itself remarkable.
Right.
Just the fact of it, you see. It would have been a luxury I would not have spent much time on trying to determine what was missing. What was missing was not so much for me, but what was missing for the overwhelming majority of other minority actors at the time.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. What were some of the things you heard from your fellow actors at the time about stereotype roles that they had to play in Hollywood when you came to Hollywood?
Yeah, well, you know, most of us, I think, were obliged to play what was available. I did not take advantage of that. I couldn't. It was not what I needed to do for my life. I had elected to be the kind of actor whose work would stand as a representation of my values.
Let me talk with you about a scene that I think represents the kind of values that you're talking about. And this is a scene from In the Heat of the Night. In that film, Rod Steiger plays a local police chief in a southern town. You're a homicide cop from Philadelphia passing through the southern town, but you're arrested for being suspicious because you're a black man from out of town carrying money in your wallet. The police chief doesn't really believe that you're a cop, so he calls your boss in Philly. And your boss suggests that you stay in this small southern town to help them solve this big murder case that they're working on, because they don't have cops who are nearly as experienced as you are. So in this scene, you and Rod Steiger, who's still very skeptical of you, go to question one of the leading white businessmen in town. And I'll just explain, in case it's confusing as our listeners hear it, that as you're questioning him, the businessman slaps you, and then without missing a beat, you slap him right back. Here's the scene.
Let me understand this. You two came here to question me?
Well, your attitudes, Mr. Endicott, your points of view are a matter of record. Some people, well, let us say the people who work for Mr. Colbert might reasonably regard you as the person least likely to mourn his passing. We were just trying to clarify some of the evidence. Was Mr. Colbert ever in this greenhouse, say, last night about midnight?
Gillespie?
Yeah.
You saw it.
I saw it.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
I don't know.
I'll remember that. There was a time when I could have had you shot.
Sidney Poitier, in your new memoir, you say that's not the way the scene was originally written. Originally, you didn't slap this businessman right after he slapped you. What did you do in the original scene, and why did you want to change it?
The original scene called for the businessman to slap me and for me to absorb it and leave. I found it reprehensible that the writers writing for that period would not have written it differently. And I felt that the natural emotional response to being slapped, as, and I'm speaking not as Sidney Poitier, but I'm speaking as a Philadelphia detective, that the natural response to a man slapping him, he's going to slap him right back. And I elected as an actor to do that, because were I the guy from Philadelphia who was slapped, I would slap the guy right back. And I thought that that would be, since those kinds of moments were never found in American films from the inception of films in this country, that kind of a scene, which would be electrifying on the screen, was always either avoided, not thought of, and I insisted that if they wished my participation in the film, that they would have to rewrite it to exemplify that. they were, meaning the director, Norman Jewison, who was and is an exquisite artist, and the producer, Walter Mirisch, who is, I mean, his record is fabulous, and we've been very good friends all these years. Both of them said, hey, that's great. Let's do it that way. So we did it. And it indeed did turn out to be a highlight moment in that film. But it also spoke not just of the two characters. It spoke of our time. It spoke of the time in America when in films, at least, we could step up to certain realities.
In that film, you use something that you've used in a lot of your films, a very indignant stare, a stare that carries a lot of weight. Can you talk a little about how you perfected that look?
I didn't perfect that look. That look is first of all, I don't acknowledge that I have such a look. I
mean, right, right.
Because I see myself differently than other people see me, obviously.
Right. But is that, do you think, a look that came from real life or one that you just developed for your acting roles?
No, my acting roles are at the core of themselves, a part of me. So whatever that look is, I mean, I cannot manufacture such a look. It comes out of those forces that are churning internally in the individual, you know? And I just have that look, I suppose, even when I'm thinking of things that are quite contrary to what the look might suggest.
Mm-hmm.
I just have that look, and I'm sorry if I've put people off with it.
Oh, not at all. No, I mean, it's a great look, and it's certainly the one you need in the roles that you use it in. So, no. Sidney Poitier, in the minute that we have remaining, I'm wondering why we don't get to see you much in movies anymore.
Listen, my darling lady, I'm 73 years old. I have been working in films for 51 years, and I've made a great number of movies. And there are other areas of my life now that the most important currency I own is my time. And I need to spend it now with a great deal of care, you know, for obvious reasons. And I just simply don't have the time to go over ground I've covered. At least I don't want to spend the remaining time I have in this life of mine doing things that I've done before.
Well, I certainly wouldn't want to begrudge you that. We just miss you in the movies.
Oh, that's very kind of you, and I thank you for that.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sidney Poitier recorded last year. His memoir, The Measure of a Man, has just been published in paperback. This is Fresh Air.